I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Rag Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. It originates on KOOP 91.7 FM in Austin, Texas. It's a community radio station that's solar powered and cooperatively run, all volunteer. Very cool place and a unique radio station, unique to the country, I think. We're rebroadcast on several other community radio stations around the country, and our podcasts are put up all over the place, and so you can listen to the show afterwards. You can go to theragblog.com/rag-radio for one place that you can find stuff. Our guest today, Alice Embry, is joining me. Alice Embry is my colleague, my associate, and sometimes sits in on our shows. She's joining me on sort of this side of the mic. And our guests are Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, our dear old friends from many decades, not to suggest that we're decades old. But So Bill and Bernadine, are you there?
We are. It's great to hear your voice.
Okay, because we had to change how we did the connection, and so that's why you heard a few underwriting announcements in a row at the beginning of the show. So, hi there. Glad that you can be with us. This is like maybe the fourth time that Bill's been on, and the second time that the two of you have been on together. So
I think that's right. It's great, really great to hear your voice, and we're looking forward to being there.
Okay, well, we're happy to have you. Say hi to Alice.
Hi.
Hey, Alice.
Hi, y'all.
Sweet Alice.
Okay, what we want to say, first I'll introduce these guys, and then I'll tell you about an event we're having, because we want to do that up at the top, and then we'll tell you at the end again, too. Legendary activists and educators Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn are joining us to discuss, among other things, Bill's new book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto, and how it addresses the problems we face at this dramatic juncture in history, or something. You know, I mean, we're going to talk about the whole picture. I mean, it's a philosophical manifesto, but it deals a lot with specific issues. So there's a lot to talk about it. We want you guys to just lay out what it's all about. But we also want to talk, I think, about what's happening in the country right now, which is actually kind of post this book, and how these ideas relate to how we can organize a movement for real change.
Yeah, I understand, Bill, that the book's publication date was September 2016, and that was... right before the election, right?
Yeah,
is that correct?
Book came out in August of 2016.
Oh, it was August.
Uh huh. And it feels prescient a little bit.
But it does.
You say it's philosophical, Thorne, and when I sat down to write it, my idea was really to write a pamphlet. I really felt that one of the things that radicals and revolutionaries and progressives are good at is kind of critiquing the system, critiquing the situation that we live in. But I think it's equally important to try to name what we're fighting for. And I was thinking as I began to write it that what we really need is a brief little program that says, this is what we want to get to. And there's a bumper sticker that kind of inspired me. And the bumper sticker is, which I'm sure you've seen, which is all over the place. And it says, if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention. And I think that's true, but I wanted to add to that, if you're only pissed off, you don't know where you're going, and you're therefore not going to get there. So this was an attempt to say, here are some of the major issues facing us, war, mass incarceration, the destruction of the public space, universal health care. How do we articulate that in a way that can be an organizing tool and really build the movement for the world we need?
Okay, that's a great setup. Thank you. I did want to tell people, for those who don't know, you're listening to Bill Ayers and before that Bernadine Dorn. Bill Ayers is a social justice activist and an elementary education theorist. He's a distinguished professor of education and senior university scholar, retired, at the University of Illinois at Chicago and the author of two memoirs, Fugitive Days and Public Enemy. And he was on this show previously to discuss Public Enemy. I guess both of you, that was you and Bernadine. Bernadine Dorn was a clinical associate professor of law at the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University School of Law, and was the first law student organizer for the National Lawyers Guild. Ayers and Dorn, who are married, were active in the 60s New Left and SDS, and worked against the war in Vietnam, and were leaders of the Weather Underground. So we've all come a long way, baby, I guess.
Indeed.
Although in many ways we're all still the same. So, and I've, you know, Alice and I both have known these guys since those days, since the 60s.
I was just going to add one thing, Thorne, which is I think neither Bill nor you mentioned the title of his book, which is Demand the Impossible.
Oh,
his latest book.
Okay, and, I guess we didn't.
So it's a great title, both because it's meant to be ironic, we have to make it possible, and also because, you know, it's attributed to Che or to the uprisings in Paris in 1968. It's scrawled on walls all over the world, and so it has a kind of a global quality of insistent rejection of the world we inhabit, but of sense that we can do better than this.
Yeah, thank you. I thought I did say it at the top, but I guess I didn't. The book is Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto, and we should note that Che Guevara said, be realistic, demand the impossible.
Exactly.
And Vijay Prashad calls Bill Ayers the philosopher of the revolutionary spirit, and Angela Davis writes that Demand the Impossible is a book that should be read by everyone who believes that another world is possible. So you guys have been married how long?
Well, married, you know. What's
or that? Together.
You've been partners.
We got married when I was in jail. I had a momentary weakness of not knowing what was coming next after we had three kids. So
kind of sounds bondish-like.
Yes, exactly. We've been together 45 years.
Wow. Very, very cool.
Holy cow.
Yeah, holy cow. Good old, that good old cow that we can.
And I'm still hoping it's going to work out.
Well, you know,
I know the feeling.
we see you over the years, and it would appear from this distance that it's working out pretty well.
Well, good. That's good.
Well, we're looking forward to your visit to Texas, and you're going to be at the High Road on Dawson, 700 Dawson Road, 6 to 8, Wednesday, June 21st, with the books for sale, with Bill and Bernadine, I hope, signing those books. And we're really looking forward to this visit, and I understand you're going to be in Dallas as well after Austin. Is that right?
Yeah, we'll be in Dallas-Fort Worth for 3 days after Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And we're being brought to Dallas by the Democratic Socialists of America, and we're going to do, I think, two bookstore events and a public lecture. And very much looking forward to being in Texas.
Well, prepare for climate change.
It's
here.
It's closing in on 100. In fact, I heard on the radio last night, they said, and it will feel like 110. I thought, what? Already?
Then we can pack lightly.
Pack lightly.
Yeah. It's going to be nude beach time. Although we don't have a beach.
We don't have a beach.
We have natural pools. The thing about the event here is that it's sponsored. The event in Austin at the High Road is sponsored by the New Journalism Project, which is
the Rag Radio and the Rag Blog.
And whatever. And by the Austin chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America.
Yeah, I heard last night I was at a meeting. And there are 660 members of DSA now in Austin. It's pretty amazing. They weren't all at the meeting.
but about over 100
they keep
come.
Running out of space.
Well, you know, one of the things that we found, we've been kind of touring with this book for a few months, and one of the things we found is that a lot of people are coming out not to support the book in particular, but because these times demand that we face one another authentically and ask real questions of ourselves and of the universe and try to figure out what we mean, for example, when we say sanctuary. What is that? What is the concrete meaning of that in this period? And I think everyone is feeling a sense of urgency that we have a huge responsibility to the present, to the future, and to our past, to say that we are going to try to build a movement that can bring about fundamental social change.
Yeah, I think that the book resonates with me because it puts out the dots. It connects the dots. It gives people a lot of background, but then it really goes bold with agenda items. And that's something I noticed that Naomi Klein was suggesting. Do not just resist, but make sure people understand what we are working for here. And you do that, you know, with all these, in several areas. So, and it's exciting.
Well, I appreciate that, and that was certainly the intention. And Naomi read the book in draft and gave me some good suggestions and a good comment or two about it. But her new book is phenomenally important and kind of charts down the same path, which is not just what we're saying no to, but what we're saying yes to. And we have within our grasp the possibility of really building a large social movement at a time of great discontent and a time when neoliberalism and the kind of crypto-fascism that we're seeing thrust upon us has no answers for most people. And we have to seize the time and make something powerful and progressive and revolutionary out of it.
And we're not starting, you know, as Naomi points out, but as we, you know, and we know, you know, there's absolutely powerful and vibrant social movements underway here in the United States. So it's not that we have to think this up in our own heads. We hopefully, you're already going to meetings every night, Alice, I know. So, you know, we are in a wonderful situation to have movements like Black Lives Matter on the ground, Undocumented, Unafraid, you know, Queer, and the Queer Movement, and Standing Rock, and on, right? So I think you know, we're not starting in the it's not as desperate as it sometimes feels each morning when you wake up and think about it. And we have a lot going on. So we're pretty hopeful about what's possible.
Yeah, I think there's a great deal of reason to be hopeful. I mean, I think the resistance is very strong. And we've had a hideous legislative session of bills that restrict, you know, that show me your papers bills on immigration. I think Texas is kind of on the front lines of some really disastrous stuff right now.
It's go ahead. I'm sorry.
And immigration is, I mean, you know, Austin, because it had advanced and elected a sheriff who did not feel that she had to be an immigration officer, got essentially called out by the governor and punished. And there were raids in February that were, I think, were 60 people picked up by ICE then. And it appears that it was, Austin targeted because of the stance that local leaders had taken.
Last week on the show.
Oh, go ahead. Very courageous. Very courageous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Last week on the show, we had Reverend Jim Rigby and our colleague Glenn Smith. And Reverend Rigby is a part of the Sanctuary Movement, and his St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church is actually housing
Ilda and Ivan, Guatemalan refugees, a woman and her son. And there's a Dance Away Detention event happening, I think, the day after your event, and so that they'll be honored at.
But in any event, there is a whole lot going on in Austin. I mean, Austin is just an amazing. I mean, you know, Austin has throughout the years been sort of a source of a lot of activism, but it looks like the '60s right now here, more so
yeah,
different.
Yeah, I think your guest highlights something that I think is really important, which is the sanctuary movement is coming out of the church and out of some neighborhoods. But the idea that we would, in Illinois or in California, leave the concept of sanctuary to the governors or to the mayors is a big mistake. The only way we can really achieve sanctuary for not only, you know, people, undocumented people, but also for activists, is if we take it into our own hands. I was thinking the other day, it's like saying the Underground Railroad, what if we had to have the governors approve of the Underground Railroad before people did it? Well, that would be ridiculous. So Bernadine and I have spent a lot of time trying to think of sanctuary as a metaphor for something much larger than something that the mayor of Chicago can kind of bless, something that really requires us to take it into our own hands.
I did want to say one more thing, and I think we're going to take a short music break in just a second. But before we do that, I wanted to mention that Alice was talking about the incredibly reactionary legislature and the stuff they've done. A lot of it, actually, a whole lot of stuff aimed at Austin and aimed at the Texas cities, which are all progressive. And trying to overturn local regulations for things like tree preservation, you know, plastic bags. I mean, all of this and a lot more serious stuff than that too. But I just saw in the paper, or maybe on cable television, I don't remember, but that a rating now that Texas, actually Donald Trump his popularity is underwater in Texas. I think 60-40 or something like that. But it doesn't make a whit of a difference because of gerrymandering and the incredible grip that the Republican, Tea Party Republican element has over the legislature.
Right. I think that's right in lots of places, and Thorne, and it argues to us that it does make a difference, that the issues that we believe in around, you know, healthcare and basic justice issues and education as a human right, those are issues that actually are majority issues. Most people do agree with us.
Right, right.
And one of the challenges for the left is to, you know, not feel barricaded and small, but to actually insist that these are majority issues, most of them. Maybe the one we have to work on the most is war, the end to war, but permanent war. But for most of these issues, the majority of people agree with us.
Okay, we do need to take a quick musical break. Anonymous is at the board of my engine. Oh no, it's Tracy Schultz. I didn't introduce him earlier, so he's not anonymous. Although we never know. So Tracy, take it away. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio, and our guests are Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. Bill is the author of Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto, and that Bill chose that music. Bill, do you want to make a comment?
He and Spearhead are one of my favorite groups, and Michael Franti has a whole lot of revolutionary music, and Yell Fire is one of his terrific cuts.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, we're back, and Alice, were you getting? Was there something you were getting ready to say before we took break or ask?
No. I'll say something. I think that a lot of young people came in, you know, activated by the Bernie campaign, and I think that one of the things I hope you'll talk about is that you know, that electoral front versus the social movement front, and how you see those interacting, because a lot of people here are inspired to believe change can happen through elections, and you know, I'm a little more jaded than that. I believe change happens through social movements, and you have
to. Well, I think we have to be. I think we have to stay complicated about it. I think that change cannot come without the constant mobilization of workers and ordinary people from below. That fire from below is what brings about change. On the other hand, as we build constantly and never give up about it, the mobilization of people, we have to engage regular politics. The problem that we have in this country is that when people want to be political, it seems the only option is the electoral route, and the electoral route in this country is so corrupted by not only money but gerrymandering and, you know, disenfranchisements of all kinds, including people coming out of prison, including the homeless. It's an outrageously rigged system, and so to spend all your energy there is a huge mistake. And, you know, one of the things I think that you agree with, Alice, is if you take just a quick glance at history, everything that we can look at and say this was a substantial progressive move forward, you can see that it comes from the mobilization of people. So Lyndon Johnson passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, but he wasn't part of the Black Freedom Movement. He was responding to the Black Freedom Movement. And go all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, he was never part of an abolitionist party. And if you read his first inaugural address, which nobody does, he's bowing down in front of the slave owners. He's saying, "I won't disrupt your enterprise." The second inaugural address is the one we all read, because it could have been written by Frederick Douglass, but that's fire from below.
I think that we both feel close to you, Alice, on so many levels, but including, you know, not having electoral politics be our primary or even our tertiary field of activity. I do think, though, that you have to look, especially at local elections, if we're not talking, you know, the carnival every 4 years of presidential elections. But, you know, for local electoral politics, we can see that this has made a huge difference in lots of interesting places in the country. You start with, you know, Seattle or the state of California, which appears to be ready to, you know, remove itself from the United States and become the fifth largest country in the world economically and population-wise. So I think I just feel like we have to be flexible about engaging in electoral politics. And I think if you take out the presidential elections every 4 years, you can see that there's some very interesting stuff happening on the ground.
Right.
But I have one more thing, which is that you know, I think that the Democratic Party is in no position to lead the resistance that's needed right now, even though many leaders of the Democratic Party are trying to jump in and say, "I'm part of the resistance." But they're trying to catch up with what's going on the ground. And the reason they're not in a position to lead is that for four decades, they've agreed on the big issues: permanent war, mass incarceration, destruction of the public space, including public schools, the financing of health care instead of universal health care. So they're not in a position to lead. But in many ways, the Women's March, the airport demonstrations, the town halls have shown us that there is an eagerness. And I also agree with you, Alice, that the Bernie campaign showed us that there's an eagerness for new ideas, for fresh ideas. But let's not get trapped into a single tactic, which is electing the right person who will solve our problems. It doesn't work that way.
Well, I like your line. Let's it's complicated, and we have to be agile on many fronts. And social movements are going to be I mean, in Central America, I think you see that in El Salvador with the social movements advancing a lot of the agenda that, you know, the Progressive Party picks up. And I think that's how it works. Should work. Does work.
So in what... Oh, go ahead, Bernie.
No. I'm just nodding and saying yes.
Oh, yeah, well, we saw the nod. We didn't hear the... Oh, okay, wait. But now just stay with us and don't nod out. Even so. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the book and how it deals with these issues and relates to these issues and to how we move forward. But I would like for you to tell us the story and tell me if I'm pronouncing his name correct, of Manolis Glezos.
You've got it right.
How about that? Do I get something?
Yeah.
Tell us about it. It's such a wonderful story.
Well, the book begins with a few years ago, I was invited to give a talk at an anarchist convention in Athens, Greece. And I joked with the young anarchist who met me at the airport. I said, "Are you sure you're anarchist? You're actually having a convention. That seems unusual." But they were lovely people, and I spent a lovely
lovely but highly pierced and tattooed, right?
They were pierced, they were tattooed, they were their hair was dyed in a variety of rainbow colors, but they were really lovely people. And I stayed in one of their squats, and they had taken over an entire neighborhood of downtown Athens. It was really a terrific time for me. But the best thing was that through mutual friends, I was introduced to a man named Manolis Glezos, and he lived on an island. He still does live on an island 5 hours by fast boat out in the archipelago that is Greece. And so I jumped on a fast boat early one morning. Manolis greeted me at the pier, and we spent a lovely afternoon together. He was 90 or 92 years old when we met. He's now 95 or 96. And he was famous throughout Europe, but particularly a hero in Greece, because he and his brother took the Nazi flag off the Acropolis during the German occupation in World War II. And his brother was killed, and he was the death penalty was put on him. He was captured eventually. And over the next several years, he did, I think, over a decade in prison, partly with the fascists and partly with the generals. But he was still at it. And we, you know, I actually read a couple months ago that he was arrested in front of the parliament again, you know, that he doesn't let up. But we had a wonderful sharing of experiences and ideas, and I was deeply impressed with him. Everyone we met knew him and greeted him. And
yeah, I was just going to say, tell us what it was like walking down the street with him.
Well, nobody passed us without stopping for a hug or a handshake or to give him a pastry or invite him in for coffee. I mean, he's really well known. He was mayor of this island at one point. And when he was mayor, he actually ran it like the ancient radical Greek democracy. That is, every big decision was made in a public forum. I mean, he's that kind of guy. But we also, there were tourists in the town, and we went into one of the big churches, and a group of tourists from Spain recognized him and came kind of thundering over to greet him. And they all knew of him partly because Picasso had done a portrait of Manolis in the 40s. So he's an amazing guy, and he's a great example to me of, you know, stick-to-itiveness and perseverance. But as we were walking back to the boat for me to go back to Athens, he said to me, "You know, Bill, I think you face the same problem in the United States that we face here. And that is that an obstacle to fundamental social change is that people don't really have the confidence that they could run their own affairs. We've been so socialized to believe that we need leaders or that we need chiefs of police or that we need mayors, that we stop believing in ourselves. And when you stop believing in yourself, you're paralyzed." And that struck home for me. And actually, I came back to Chicago during the mayoral election, and every public meeting that the progressives had, I would stand up and say, "Why do we need a mayor?" And eventually people say, "Shut up, Bill, we need a mayor." So, okay, we need a mayor. But I was very taken with this idea that deep down in our hearts, do we believe that another world is possible? And do we believe that that we could be the agents of creating that world. I do, and I think that we have to all sharpen our ability to see what's up ahead through the fog.
Okay. I want to remind people that you're listening to Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, also with us is Alice Embry. Bill and Bernadine, longtime activists for social and economic justice, and in recent times have done an incredible amount of wonderful work as educators and activists. The Bill's new book is Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto, and they will be appearing in Austin and in other places. I guess y'all are doing this in, around the country?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, somewhat. Dallas and Austin, that's pretty much around the country.
That's a lot of country.
Right. And you will, you're going to be signing copies of the book at the High Road on Dawson in Austin, Wednesday, June 21st from 6 to 8 p.m., and speaking and leading a discussion. So that's cool. So go ahead. Tell us a little bit more then about how you organized this book in order to be able to do what you're talking about doing, and Alice just
where you began is disarm, and it's unbelievable when you lay out the stats that you lay out. I mean, I think we all have to look at those probably once a day. How much of our national wealth goes to militarization? So that's where you begin.
Yeah.
That's where the resources are.
I pre-begin before chapter one, which is disarm. And you notice that the title of every chapter is more or less a bumper sticker. Disarm, abolition, universal health care. You know, I'm trying to say this is not complicated, but let's change the frame. But the introduction of the book is a plea to unleash our radical imaginations. That as long as we're stuck in the debates that they give us, like, are we for Obamacare or are we for the Republican health care plan? And we need to cry out quite loudly and firmly, none of the above. We have a different idea altogether. So we don't, you know, in the chapter on war, you're absolutely right. It's appalling to realize. Bernadine often quotes Martin Luther King in 1967 saying, the United States government is the greatest purveyor of violence on this earth. That was 50 years ago. That greatest purveyor label has only gotten greater. And here we are wanting to believe that we're a peace-loving nation, wanting to believe that our military does good in the world, wanting to say again and again, every politician, violence doesn't accomplish anything. And yet we've launched the biggest violent force ever imagined on Earth. So we need to kind of get out of the argument, should we bomb them into the Stone Ages, a la Donald Trump, or should we strangle them and force our will upon them that way? And again, the answer is none of the above. We need to learn to live as a nation among nations, equal with other nations, and not the uber nation who imposes our will through invasion and occupation.
I think it's great the way in the opening of the book you have a quote from Noam Chomsky, which kind of speaks to that whole question of whether that we have to start thinking, I guess in some ways outside the box, but not allow the discussion to be limited. The quote is, the smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum, even encourage the more critical and dissident views. That gives people the sense that there's free thinking going on, while all the time the presuppositions of the system are being reinforced by the limits put on the range of the debate.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly.
Wish I had said that myself.
You can look at any piece of this and just be appalled, you know, Afghanistan, now the longest U.S. war, surpassing Vietnam by a couple of years. And you know, Iraq, of course, another total failure, and Syria, where the responsibility, I think, for the U.S. is very heavy, even though we like to think it's somebody else's problem, because the United States invaded Libya. You know, that was going to be the good war, Obama's good war. I think, you know, this kind of rallying, and I fear, actually, that Trump may figure this out, you know, that this is popular among Democrats as well as among Republicans, that there's nothing like a little war when you're in trouble as a presidential, as the most unpopular president ever. So I think if we can't really talk enough or clear our heads enough to realize that whatever kinds of activism we're doing, we have to tie it to the state of permanent war and unraveling permanent war. So whether we're talking about climate or gay rights or we're talking about immigrant rights or workers' rights or domestic workers or the National Nurses Association, no matter what we're talking about, I think we can very clearly and strongly and powerfully tie it into an end to war.
Yeah, in fact, I think that you can take any one of the issues that concerns you and dive fully into that issue, anyone can, and reframe the debate. And that's really what I'm attempting to do with those eight substantive chapters. So we can reframe the debate. It's not between the bombers and the stranglers. It's between peace and aggression. And we want to be on the side of peace. In the schools debate, it's not between vouchers and charters. It's between the question of whether education is a human right or a product to be sold at the marketplace. And once you reframe the discussion, then I think you need to connect the issues. So war is connected to warming, is connected to a dumbed-down educational system. All these things need to be connected, and then we have the real seeds of a real social movement.
Okay. Tracy, are you still over there?
Yeah.
Oh, I see you.
Yeah.
We're listening to Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, but we're going to take another musical break. I think we're going to hear from the boss.
Men walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over the ridge. Hot soup on a campfire in the bridge. Shelter line stretching around the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Family sleeping in the car in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Highway is alive tonight, but nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line, searching for the ghost of Tom Joe. He pulls a prayer book out of his sleeping bag. Preacher lights up a butt and takes the drag. Waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. In a cardboard box near the underpass. Got a one-way ticket to the promised land. You got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand. Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock. Bathing in the city.
Okay, Bruce, Tom Joad.
Great stuff.
Great stuff. Wonderful. All right, we're talking with Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. We've got about 15 minutes left, and things just go so fast, you know, when you're having fun. And so, when you were talking, Bill, about the idea of that certain things being basic assumptions that we don't question, and one of the givens is that endless war concept, I think, and I just thought it was really telling that when Donald Trump was first trying to get his legs, I guess, I don't know, and everybody was, you know, talking about how he was just certainly not within the norms of the office, suddenly he bombed Afghanistan. And everybody said, wow, he's presidential. So,
yeah, I mean, that was really the lowest moment for Brian Williams.
And yes, Brian Williams.
Plenty of low moments, but yeah, when the liberals stand up and salute when war happens, this is a terrible, terrible thing.
You know, I think that we are one of the most powerful movements in my lifetime, and it rises and falls in its visibility, is the movements of vets coming home and becoming anti-war activists. And, of course, that's still going on to this very moment. You guys remember the Under the Hood and all the activity at Fort Hood there. But I think it's very important to continue to highlight the powerful threads of anti-war resistance that still are dramatic across the United States. You know, parents not wanting their kids to become soldiers, and the kind of billion-dollar ads to recruit younger and younger kids, and kids that don't really make the criteria because there is resistance to this. And so that seems to me to be something that we have to highlight and build upon and add to, because the cost to the world is so great, and because the cost to our young people is always so enormous.
I should note, for those who don't know, Under the Hood was a GI coffee house in Killeen, Texas, at Fort Hood or near Fort Hood. In fact, Alice was involved with Under the Hood, and it dates back to the grand tradition of the Oleo Strut, which is a GI coffee house during the Vietnam War. So anyway,
exactly.
That's just for people who don't
and
know.
And that whole coffee house tradition, of course, across the country, became a very powerful recruitment for the anti-war movement in Vietnam, and then rose up again when you guys were part of it, as you guys were part of it.
So, okay, what next? What else about the book? About the way.
Well, I would highlight one thing, which is the prison state. I think that this is you know, the fact that we have been unable to think our way out of the fact that if somebody breaks the law or does something wrong or is in the wrong place, in the wrong color, that the punishment, necessary punishment, is mass incarceration and incarceration for longer and longer periods of time. So I've been involved in this work for the last 30 years involving children because nobody else in the United States, you know, and nobody else in the world was sentencing children to life imprisonment and life without parole for crimes they committed when they were children. And we were the last country in the world to be executing, having the death penalty for child offenders. So there's a, you know, this deep reliance on punishment and pain in prison, isolation and death as part of our murder machinery is something that I think easy to break open and doable. And I think we're in a moment where it's doable on a million levels. And we're slowly rolling back certain kinds of crimes and sentences that are attached to them. But we could just move very rapidly. A kind of jail, for example, here in Chicago, houses 9,000 African-American and Latino, primarily young men, 8,000 of them pre-trial. You know, why? That's an atrocity. It should end tomorrow. It should end today. If all we have to do is have somebody show up for trial, we can do that. A million different strategies are available to have somebody show up for trial or to not commit a crime between now and then. But incarcerating them in this massive 10-square-block dungeon on the west side of Chicago, it's an absolute outrage, and we should end it.
And it gets even more perverse when you get a private prison industry rising up and building detention centers in Texas, near Conroe, Texas, right now, and other places. I mean, these are places where you see immigrant immigrants held with children. They actually passed a bill here that allowed the prisons to be child care centers because they were being sued, you know, that they weren't appropriate places to have children. And
no, you're exactly right, Alice. And, that, you know, the expansion, I mean, even the public prisons are highly privatized.
Right.
You know, the food services, the health services, the telephone, the whole thing is highly privatized. But
right.
These actually for-profit prisons that you're pointing to have had an area to flourish in around incarcerating undocumented people.
Mm-hmm.
And throwing people right directly into prison at the border. So this is a particular atrocity that this is a profit center, a naked profit center, as well as a Dickensian, really, notion of how we should operate as a society.
I know you've done a lot of work in that area, in juvenile justice area.
Well, Bernadine. I think a lot of young people come into mm-hmm. the movement this mm-hmm. way. I'm always amazed at how many, you know, new young people are thrown into activity like Black Lives Matter here around, you know, ending the carceral state. And
mm-hmm.
I think around immigrant rights, that's equally true. So, yeah, I feel very lucky that I came of age in an academic institution at a time where we were able to abolish the juvenile death penalty, for example, as part of a broader anti-death penalty movement. You know, and it took us 5 years of organizing and activism, and we were able to do it. And then now we're taking on life sentences for kids. In Chicago, you know, there was a one of the police precincts where the commander in charge was suspects into coerced confessions. And everybody knew about this, actually. Lawyers knew about it, prosecutors, defense lawyers, the mayor, politicians knew about it. It went on for 20 years. And there was campaign after campaign to get John Burge fired, Commander John Burge fired. And it's a long and beautiful story, but eventually he was put on trial. He was his pension was taken away. He was put on trial and convicted. And then Black Lives Matter ended up by demanding a reparations for the torture victims, the people who had survived torture and imprisonment in the state of Illinois. One of the most extraordinary stories, we'll tell it when we're on stage here, where a reparations agreement was forged out with Mayor Rahm Emanuel, of all people, and the city council.
Mm-hmm.
Because the evidence was so overwhelming about what the state had done over a period of 30 years.
It
wants me to tell you a couple of the seven incredible demands. Can I tell you real quickly?
Yes.
Okay. So the first one was that 105 survivors of torture were given a check for $100,000 each.
Mm.
Second thing was that there was an apology from the city of Chicago for this regime of torture that went on for 30 years. Third, there was every one of those 110 people, there was free community college for them, their children, and their grandchildren.
Oh.
Fourth, there was a curriculum to be developed that would be taught in the Chicago public schools for the next 15 years about the police torture scandal. Fifth, there is going to be a torture justice center, torture treatment center on the south side in Area 2 police station, like there is for people from other countries, torture centers for the victims of torture, to actually treat them and their whole families
mm-hmm.
and progeny.
That happened
this one
in Chile.
Will be for mm-hmm. Chicago residents. And sixth, there's going to be a memorial, some kind of statue or art, some kind of memorial that will be seen by everybody who visits Chicago. So that kind of a reparations agreement signed by the mayor and the city council and funded now is astonishing, isn't it? But
yes, it is.
30 years, It's a 30-year struggle.
Yeah. A lot of activism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're down to about 4 minutes, a little over 4 minutes. Right now, we're looking at a pretty unique time in American history, it seems like, or at least recent American history. The right wing, which is, you know, has become very right wing. I mean, it's the pendulum has swung so far. And the Republicans are so good at consolidating power, and so many things are being reversed, and that includes when we talk about the prisons. They're reinvigorating the war on drugs, things that in Texas, even the Texas legislature was realizing the craziness of keeping so many people in prison and was involved in prison, has been involved in prison reform. You know, that so many things are being moved backwards, and who knows how long, and now the Cuba, Trump's Cuba move. How do we address that? How do we respond to that? How do we fight that? Are we just going to have to look at a period of regression?
I don't think so.
Do you think just fighting on the grassroots level?
When we started talking, Bernadine said, you know, that we're not starting from zero. Donald Trump doesn't come from nowhere. He comes from somewhere. So you look at something like education. It's true that Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, is a monster, but she's a monster for whom the road was laid down by Arne Duncan and liberals and Democrats and Republicans. So yes. Donald Trump isn't completely out of the blue or unique. Once you agree about permanent war, once you agree about mass incarceration, once the country is on a path of privatization and austerity, Donald Trump is one option. The thing that so he doesn't come from nowhere, and neither do we. The fact is, he ran a campaign explicitly as a fascist campaign. We not only have to resist, we are resisting. And the first test really was the Women's March on January 21st. The most astonishing outpouring around the country and around the world of people opposed to this guy who ran as a fascist. Now, I don't say everyone who voted for him was a fascist, but I think it's important that we say he ran on a program of criminalizing entire neighborhoods, of trying to roll back every progressive impulse that we've ever had in the last century. And he ran with scapegoats, and he ran with the idea of consolidating power between the corporate and the politicians and the military. I think we have to resist. And I think while it's a grim time, it's also a hopeful time, because the options, you know, of how to respond to it are narrow. And one option is not going back to neoliberalism and austerity. That's not the option. The option we have to offer, and this is where maybe Bernie Sanders comes in. He provided the idea on the ground of socialism, and it resonated with a lot of people. It needs to go farther. It needs to go in a more serious direction. But I think we're poised to come up with new solutions to build a new social movement that can challenge not only fascism, but the return to neoliberalism.
Okay, we have 30 seconds. fill it up. Close it out.
We can't wait to see you. We're
oh, so it'll be wonderful.
To talk to people in Texas and to see our dear old friends.
Okay, and we have to, and so we're going to remind people that Bill and Bernadine, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn will speak, and Bill will sign copies of his book at the High Road on Dawson in Austin, Wednesday, June 21st from 6 to 8 p.m. Copies of the book will be available for sale, as will copies of Celebrating the Rag, Austin's iconic underground newspaper, published by the New Journalism Project. And it's possible that the editors might even agree to sign copies of that book, with a little urging and a tip. And that's going to be a lot of fun. And then you guys are going to be in Dallas the next day, right? Okay,
exactly.
You can't answer. We've got 3 seconds.
Thorn,
I'm Thorn Dreyer, and this is
Rag
Radio.